Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Herman Mahari is one of the hottest trumpet players in town these days and evidence that the jazz scene in Kansas City can still kick it. He's got a fragile tone and an engaging smile which comes across even on the radio. Here's betting that you're going to like this guy. Later on this hour, Brian McTavish is in the house with your weekend to-do list. But first up, a new book looks at jazz from an intriguing vantage point. Mark Myers, a frequent contributor to the Wall Street Journal, looks at the cultural and technological forces that shaped the music, especially after World War II. The book is titled Why Jazz Happened. Frequent listeners of this program know that I'm a huge jazz fan, and I can tell you from frequent clicks that Mark Myers' Jazz Wax blog is simply one of the finest blogs on any subject out there. You can find it at jazzwax.com, and you can find Mark Myers here with us right now. Mark, good morning. So good to have you.
Steve, thanks for having me, and thanks for your kind words.
How did you get the idea, Mark, to look at the music from the vantage point of why it came to be in the first place?
You know, jazz, for the most part, jazz writing has always looked at the music from the inside out, looking at musicians, mm-hmm. which musicians replaced other musicians, which trends came and went. But it was always inside the music, which is a little prohibitive for people who maybe don't know that much about jazz. For me, I was more curious as to how these particular styles happened at specific points in time. We know that the musicians are geniuses, but how is it that this genius emerges exactly when it does over that 30-year time period from 42 to 72.
Well, you begin this book with a look at a group called the Original Dixieland Jazz Band, the group that recorded the first jazz recording. Let's listen a little bit here. You know, you write, Mark, that the group employed a firm 1-2 beat and the musicians played with wild abandon. This was 1917, and I'm wondering what was going on in the country that triggered wild music like that?
Well, you know, it's right at the absolute dawn of World War II for the
yes.
United States. The United States is about to go into World War II. The country's pretty
frantic.
World
War I, right? Yeah.
Excuse me, World War I,
yeah.
Of course. And the automobile is suddenly on the streets. So the music, in many ways, not only reflects the anxieties of the public, but it also, in fact, reflects the anxiety of traffic.
Huh.
You know, these cars trying to come in and out and figure out how to navigate the streets without running people over or hitting into each other.
And the Original Dixieland Jazz Band tested the technical limits of the studios in those days. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, the group originally was going to record down at the Woolworth Building for Columbia, but Columbia couldn't figure out how to mic these crazy sounds. They, you know, things were too loud, things were too soft, certain instruments needed to be closer or further away, and Columbia just threw up its hands and said, let's forget the whole thing, boys. So what they did entrepreneurially is they went over to Columbia's early competitor, RCA, of course, and they wound up being recorded in Midtown Manhattan in 1917, by RCA.
And again, you point out there were a number of factors that brought this music out to a wide audience. You know, you cite the band's considerable ambitions, a sudden brainstorm of the band members to go over to RCA Victor and record there, Victor's driving ambition to outdo its rival studio, Columbia, and something else. You mentioned the public's pre-war jitters that found an outlet in this music. Which of those factors do you think was the most important one?
You know, I think it's the technology. To be honest with you, you know, Columbia would have recorded these guys. They were all set to do it because the Original Dixieland Jazz Band was having a sensational run at a nightclub or a, you know, restaurant club in Columbus Circle, and they were the rage. So Columbia wanted to record them, but technologically they didn't know how to do it because of the disparity of the instruments and the sonics. But RCA did know how to do it. And that's why this music is, I mean, keep in mind, jazz is around since 1905, 1906 down in New Orleans. But it's not until 1917 that the technology catches up and they're able to actually capture the sonics of this band without blowing out the engineering.
And they actually sort of arrange the musicians around the room in a way so to adjust for sound levels with the one microphone they had in the room, right?
Yeah, it's just, you know, microphone back then was just a very long cone, lack of a better way to put it. I mean, it's just this long metal cone. And the instruments have the RCA genius is that the guy figures out that they have to stand at different depths in the room away from this horn so that the music comes together at an audio level that is equal among all of the instruments and so that the listener actually can hear what's going on the record.
We're visiting with Mark Myers about his new book, Why Jazz Happened. You talk about Kansas City's brand of swing that came of age in the late 20s and 30s. Any sense of why Kansas City's swing came about and how influential was our music here?
Kansas City is massive. I mean, the influence of Kansas City on jazz that follows after the 1930s is extraordinary. I think there's probably two factors. One is, of course, Tom Pendergrass, who opens up the city and, you know, pretty much makes it a wild time for all. But, you know, what you have in the 1930s, and the reason what Kansas City jazz is so different is it's the 4-4 beat rather than the 2-4 dance step. And there's also this interchange or call and response among different sections of the orchestra itself, Count Basie, Benny Moten, and so on. But I think if I were looking at that period, what I would want to look at is the rise of the railroads and the intersection of railroads in Kansas City. It's the clickety-clack, the 4-4 clickety-clack of the railroads, and all of these musicians traveling to and from New York and touring all over the Midwest. Kansas City's a hub. Everybody who's playing jazz at the time has to get on a train to make a living. And as a result, what you hear in the music is the clickety-clack or 4-4 beat of Kansas City jazz.
Well, let's run through a host of other factors at play as World War II comes to an end, Mark, because you write about the radio, the creation of records, the phonograph, the jukebox, and these talkies or sound films that came along around that time. All of this, obviously, huge impact on the music. How much so?
It's extraordinary. I mean, what most people don't realize is that musicians in the 1920s and 1930s, most prominently, and into the early 1940s, they're at war with technology. You see the rise of radio in the 20s. You see the rise of the jukebox, phonograph, records, and talkies, as you point out, Steve. And the musician is, you know, there's a small group of musicians who are doing very well financially as a result of being recorded and their music being played. But for the large bulk of so-called average musicians, everyday musicians, they're becoming unemployed. They're being put out of work by movie theaters, and jukeboxes are just being plugged in, and little restaurants and bars don't have to hire a combo anymore. So the musician is very much at war up until about 1942, at which point the musicians decide to ban all recording. The Musicians Union prohibits its members starting in August of 1942. They prohibit their members from recording anything for the next 2 years.
And this recording ban by the American Federation of Musicians, you write a lot about this in the book. This is a huge moment in the development of jazz. Because why, Mark?
And inadvertently, which is what's fascinating about it, it's a labor dispute, right? It has nothing to do with music one way or the other. But what happens is that when these musicians stop recording for, you know, they basically they're going to ban their recordings and they're just going to continue not to record for an endless period of time. The big three record companies at the time, Columbia, RCA, and Decca, steadfastly say, don't worry, we'll sweat it out. But Decca, after a year, is facing bankruptcy. It just can't handle it anymore, and they need to put out new records. So Decca throws in the towel. They sign with the Musicians Union, and at the same time, hundreds of little labels pop up in New York and around the country to take the exact same deal as Decca. Why is this significant? Because in February 1944, after the Decca deal is done, bebop, for the very first time, is documented in New York on Apollo Records, one of these small little labels. Bebop, of course, Dizzy Gillespie had been fooling around with that music since 1939, and we can hear some of it in the music in the early 1940s. But it's not until 1944, after this particular labor dispute is over for one label and all these little labels, is this music finally documented, and it changes everything.
And when Mark Myers talks about bebop, he's talking about Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. Let's listen to a little bit from the quintet. That's Perdido, that's Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie, and bebop takes the country by storm, right, Mark?
Yeah, and of course, you know, where is Charlie Parker from? He's from Kansas City.
You bet
so
he
you
is.
See the you see the direct link from Kansas City, from the clickety-clack of the trains, Count Basie, and then you hear Charlie Parker in New York playing this 4/4 music, but with also with this interesting way of playing music that is flattened fifths. I mean, there's a whole bunch of technical things going on here, but at the end of the day, it's the blues.
And it catches on why, Mark? What's happening that causes this music to catch the way it did?
Well, you know, in 1944, after this music's recorded, nobody cares. Much of the country, most of the radio stations around the country hate the music. They don't want to play it at all in their markets. So in 1944, bebop is a New York expression. What happens over the years is that the radio disc jockeys, concert promoters like Norman Granz, you know, the disc jockeys like Freddie Robbins and Symphony Sid, and also what you have is the incredible rise of the jazz media. Downbeat, Metronome, Barry Yulianoff, Leonard Feather, George Simon, they're all three of these groups are championing bebop as the next wave. And finally, as radio station signals strengthen after World War II and more radio stations are given licenses by the FCC, the bebop sound is able to go out of New York and picked up and enjoyed by other markets. Again, non-jazz events that actually had a lot to do and everything to do with fostering the genius of the jazz musician.
You know, this is so interesting to me because you point out in the book that a whole series of jazz styles emerged, 10 in total, in fact, with one new one emerging about every 5 years. It had a very nice rhythm to it, didn't it?
Yeah, you know, it's amazing how that happens. And of course, all of these changes occur because of two things. One, the new musicians have genius ideas, given, we understand that. But there are these external forces, external events that happen that allow for the either for opportunity or stand in musicians' way. You know, if the phonograph and recording studios existed in 1350, perhaps somewhere in Europe someone would have invented bebop. But it's only at these critical points in time that the music changes because of external pressures and external opportunities.
What's also really interesting to me, there's this seismic change in the music that occurs after World War II, where suddenly the artistry of individual musicians begins to flourish rather than the commercial interests of these few large record companies you were talking about. This is a huge change that really spurs and leads to the future of jazz, and that focus on the individual comes about because the diversification of the music among a whole bunch of smaller studios, right?
Yeah, I mean, you hit it right on the head. Before 1942, jazz is, for the most part, a dance form, you know, music being recorded for dancing purposes, or it's blues. It's a folk music. But after 1942, with the rise of micro labels, with the rise of Capitol Records, with the rise of all these other record companies into the late 1940s, what you see is an increasing demand, especially with the introduction of the LP, the long-playing record. Remember those, Steve?
Mm-hmm.
The long-playing record,
Don't
the album.
Don't date me too quickly here, Mark.
But, you know, when you see that introduction, it's more real estate. You know, there's more vinyl to fill. And record companies are hungry now for not only individual jazz musicians' expressions, longer solos, original compositions, but they also want them to expand, to have a good time with it. So jazz musicians, for the most part, are suddenly able to express themselves in a longer format.
And what's interesting is that eventually, you know, going now down the road decades, this focus on the individual and away from dance music has led to a massive decline in the music we're talking about here.
Well, you know, it has, but, you know, there are so many factors that contribute to where things are today, of course. You know, the digital era, you know, starting in about year 2001, with the rise of two pieces of, again, non-jazz influences, two pieces of technology. One is, of course, iTunes and the iPod, the ability to put music digitally on your computer. But even more important than that, or equally important, is the rise of the at-home high-speed modem. You know, once people are able to start downloading and shopping for music that way, it really does change everything. Stores go out of business. Kids, you know, no albums are no longer important. Tracks are important. So the dynamic has changed, and so has the culture.
Well, while we're on the topic, how is all of this going to affect jazz music and, for that matter, popular music at large? What are the macro trends you see happening out there these days?
I think jazz, you know, is still in a state of idle. In other words, from about 1972 on, jazz has pretty much been a repertory form, meaning that it's celebrated what has come before it. It's looked back nostalgically at different groups that performed, and festivals tend to do that, and musicians tend to play songs people are familiar with, older songs. Then the question becomes, well, if jazz doesn't change, can jazz survive? If jazz just continues to look back, is that really jazz anymore, or is it just a museum piece? And I think for jazz to change, two things have to happen. One, jazz has to become a more visual live experience. You know, everybody knows today, who's gone to a rock or pop concert, that the music isn't just loud, it's visual. You see things happening on stage, for better or worse. And I think jazz, need to attract a younger audience, is going to have to create a visual component to what they're doing, so that the eye is entertained as well as the ear. And the other thing is, in jazz, working against jazz, of course, is that music today is not melody centric. It's very hard to think of a current hit that you could actually hum, right? Yeah. It's beat-centric, and the bass is the big instrument today, and the drum. So unless, jazz has always been built on music that it could jazz up. Without a distinct melody, jazz is really in a struggle now to invent new music, but it will have to deliver a visual component to remain relevant, I think.
You know, it's so interesting to hear you say that, Mark, because in our second half today, after you leave us, Herman Mahari, a young Kansas City player, is going to be on the show, and he's a guy who should be on your radar screen. But this is, he's working, hip-hop beats and visual stuff and Michael Jackson tribute shows and all these different kinds of things to spur and create, new interest in the music. And here in town, it's working.
It's a joy. I mean, for me, I love that. I love Robert Glasper, Esperanza Spalding. I mean, Terlin Carrington. All of these artists who are integrating the 70s soul sound, treating soul of the 70s like Tin Pan Alley, and using those themes, but then in the digital age, texturing and layering in other sounds and other beats and nostalgia for the 70s and radio and all this stuff coming together. You know, in the digital age, we now can sit on a computer and integrate all of this stuff into a wonderful quilt. And these musicians are pioneering a form that I think will end up being the dominant form.
Our guest again today, Mark Myers. He's a contributor to the Wall Street Journal, a frequent contributor. His new book is Why Jazz Happened. He's also the curator of an absolutely terrific jazz blog, jazzwax.com. Check it out. A terrific blog that looks at not only jazz, but all kinds of different forms of music. Let's move on to a different style of music, Mark. This one is called cool jazz. Very popular in its day, still popular today. And here you've got to think about a couple of guys named Chet Baker and Jerry Mulligan. Mark, this is called West Coast Cool music. What gave rise to West Coast Cool?
Well, what you don't hear in there, interestingly, Steve, is, you don't hear two things. One, there's no piano at all in that group. And the other is that the bass drum, the drum itself, is almost non-existent. It's like a cat whisker beat going on there. It's not a dominant sound. So, it's also I think anybody who even doesn't know anything about jazz listening now would know that that's sort of happy music, right? It's upbeat, and there's a conversation going on between the baritone sax and the trumpet there. And, what's happening in California at this time is California is, non-jazz events, to get back to the theme of the book, what's happening there is an unprecedented suburban expansion in California. California suburbs are growing faster than any suburb in the country at this period in the early 1950s. Why? Because it's the post-war defense industry is attracting millions and millions of people, and the GI Bill is allowing them to purchase homes at a very, very cheap price, and each of these homes needs a phonograph, and phonographs mean LPs, and everybody's listening to music that reflects that environment, the seashore, the long sunsets, great weather all year round, the highway, the cloverleaf high, all of these things that we equate with Los Angeles, white Los Angeles, for lack of a better way to put it at this time, is being celebrated in this music. It's a different form, but just as bebop reflected the intensity and compressed anxiety and drive of New York and the urban market, this music is reflecting the laid-back open spaces where you have to drive to reach any point.
You know, you can really hear California in that music. There's absolutely no question about it.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, you hear the automobile in there also. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. people, well, you have to understand from my perspective, when I look at this stuff as a social historian, as a writer, it's okay, something happened, but why? So why is it happening then? And then you have to look at all these external forces. These musicians aren't living in the same warehouse someplace, knowing nothing except a sandwich every day and going back to work. You know, they're going shopping, they're going for a drive, they're going to the beach. You know, it's interesting. Art Pepper, you know, alto saxophonist, I'm sure you know well, you know, I once said to his widow, Lori Pepper, I said, you know, there's a lot of the surf in California. I've been out to California quite a bit. And, you know, the Pacific surf is so important, it sounds like, to that music. I mean, am I crazy? And she mm-hmm. says, Art loved to body surf every day. He loved swimming. Mm-hmm. So the environment has everything to do with the product.
You cite at this point in the history of the music, again in the years after World War II, the GI Bill as another key moment, the bill that gave so many soldiers and also musicians the opportunity to go to college, higher education. Why was that so important?
Well, you know, with the passage of the GI Bill in June 44, you see a couple of things. The two most important things, of course, is free education for veterans and also, you know, outrageously low, almost non-existent home loans for GIs, you know, veterans purchasing homes. So, you know, on the one hand, you have large numbers of GIs who are musicians now able to go to music school, which means classical training for the most part. So they're studying modern classical artists like Darius Milhaud, which is, who Dave Brubeck is studying with mm-hmm. out in California. And you're seeing exposure, you're seeing jazz musicians exposed to classical forms, modern classical for the first time. And the GI Bill is also allowing for mass home ownership across the country in these Levitt towns, wherever it is. You know, it's large numbers of people owning homes. Homes need phonographs. And as I said before, that's where you see record sales surge in the 1950s with the introduction of the long playing record and home phonographs that are, you know, demanding these LPs.
We've mentioned the 33 and a third RPM disc that so many of us grew up with. How about the 45 that came along in, I think it was 1949? That was a fairly significant event too, Mark.
Oh, huge. I mean, it's just an incredible technological development. You know, when Columbia introduces the LP in 1948, it's a radical solution. And Columbia said to RCA, we'll give you the technology. Let's just all start doing 33 and a thirds. It's a better format. The homeowner, the home listener is going to be able to sit in the chair longer. It's a good thing. And RCA said, you know, stubborn as they were as a rival, said, there's no way we're doing that. And what they did a year later is they said, well, you know, let's develop and introduce our own format. So they introduced this thing called the 45. It has a big hole in the middle. And, you know, you say to yourself, well, the 45 is so much smaller than the 78. How could that possibly be a rival? Well, RCA made this phonograph that dropped these 45s rapidly. They thought that was, you know, going to compete with the 33 and a third. And, you know, The crazy thing is that the reason RCA has to give that up or at least adopt the 33 and a third is its huge stable of lucrative classical musicians in the early 1950s say, look, if you don't switch to the 33 and a third, we're going to Columbia. We're leaving RCA. And that was their bread and butter, classical. That's where the sales really came from. So RCA, you know, they adopted the 33 and a third, and they kind of shunted the 45 off to the side. Well, the 45 became the perfect medium, of course, to replace everything in the jukebox and to go onto radio stations that were popping up all over the country as the FCC handed out an increasing number of licenses to independent stations with the rise of television to compete in those markets. So suddenly the 45 has a new purpose. Once you see the rise of the portable phonograph for kids, that was the iPod in its day. So the kids now have these portable phonographs. They can go up to their room, listen to 45s, and the rest is rock and roll history, right?
You know, one final style development I wanted to hit was the rise of electronic instruments in jazz. Let's hear a little bit from Miles Davis. This is from In a Silent Way. ¶¶ I think that's John McLaughlin on electric guitar there, right?
Yeah, that is one of the great Miles Davis recordings that's not known, because Bitches Brew, of course, you know, is so prevalent in our culture. But In a Silent Way is one of the great Miles Davis recordings.
One of the great ones. And what helped usher in the electronic era, Mark? What was changing in the late 60s that suddenly brought these new instruments into Miles Davis, his repertoire here?
Well, it's pragmatism and survival. I mean, jazz, you know, rock and roll goes electric in the early 1950s. Folk goes electric, I guess, with Dylan at Newport in 65. And jazz sort of stubbornly holds on as an acoustic form until the late 1960s, when they start to see tens and hundreds of thousands of kids showing up at these rock concerts, these rock festivals, you know, like Miami and Atlantic City and Woodstock. So jazz, in order to reach the younger audience, in order to connect with them, they suddenly realize that they've got to go electric. They've got to, you know, the electric guitar, the electric bass, the keyboard, the Fender Rhodes, the organ, all of this stuff has to become integrated into a form that they can then compete with rock and roll. But it's also that most of these musicians are very young at the time. They're identifying with rock and roll. They're seeing this is their music. Yeah. While they don't want to give up jazz, you know, guys like Gary Burton and Larry Coryell and John McLaughlin don't want to give up jazz. They also see the merits of rock and roll and why it's so powerful. And then you see, you know, the need to combine this. Also, jazz wasn't going to be heard if it didn't start going electric. You know, you can entertain people in a club, but if you're going to go into a concert hall of more than 3,500, 4,000 people, you better be able to play loud, because that's the other important factor. That's the other important why jazz happened in the late 60s. Jazz needed to go electric so it could be heard, but it also needed to be able to be cranked up. You needed volume, because kids wanted volume, right?
I was going to say, if our listeners want to go out and buy a great unsung jazz recording, as Mark Myers just suggested, go out and get Miles Davis In a Silent Way and go home tonight and just crank it, because it's a great way to spend some time. Mark Myers, such an interesting conversation, such an interesting book. Really appreciate you taking some time with us, Mark.
Steve, great being with you, and my love to Kansas City, please.
You bet. All the best, Mark. His book, again, Why Jazz Happened, his blog, jazzwax.com. Spend some time with it. It's a good way to learn some new stuff about popular music and jazz in our culture today.